Welcome back to the podcast Deserts to Grassland. Today we'll be discussing with Roger Savory why he thinks his team can win the X Prize for carbon removal. I also wanted to dive into a little bit about carbon capture and carbon sequestration, specifically as it relates to grasslands. My question to Roger is, what can sequester more carbon, grasslands or forests? Because I think the answer may surprise most people. But before we discuss the X Prize and carbon sequestration and carbon capture, I wanted to ask Roger about his experience with biochar. He started playing with biochar a few decades ago on a pretty large scale, and after doing some research and the experiments, came up with quite an interesting perspective on what he believes about biochar that I think is really important to talk about now because it's become so trendy. Now with climate change, you know, we're looking for what is the best way to capture carbon and for carbon sequestration. You know, is it this method? Is it that method? And so I think this is the perfect time to discuss that. Roger, you've had quite a bit of experience with biochar. Can you tell us about it?
Because I look at things holistically, and I always use the holistic management decision-making framework to test decisions, one of the things we do in holistic management is we always look at something, and then when we come up with a great idea, we always presume we are wrong, and then we look for the earliest evidence that in fact we were wrong, so we can rethink things. Originally, when biochars were first presented to the world, they really did sound fantastic. There was research out of the Amazon that showed people in Amazonia 800 years ago used biochar, and look, the soils were still healthy and fertile, and look how great it was. So the concept seemed good, but the concept, the more I looked into it, I kind of realized we haven't actually thought this through fully. I have done large-scale biochar production. One of the properties I was managing in Australia, they had had a hurricane that had come through that had literally blown over millions of ironbark trees. So we made the decision that we could profit from them. We could make biochar and we could export it. Well, actually, more importantly, we could make charcoal, export the charcoal, and then the non-good quality stuff, we could make biochar, activate it, and also sell biochar. We built the kettles, we built everything. We were making quite a bit of it. But the more I looked into it, I then realized that there's a difference between biological carbon and chemical carbon. Chemical carbon is coal, it's gray oxidizing grass plants, and it takes a form of, it's a chemical cycle. So fire and oxidization break it down. Whereas biological carbon, you, me, a cow, grass, a living tree are all biological carbon. So we're part of the biological life cycle. When we're talking about drawing atmospheric carbon out of the atmosphere and sequestering it, what we really need to be saying is that we need to be getting the biological carbon cycle functioning again. Because whether it's chemical carbon in the form of coal or biochar or petroleum going into the atmosphere and, you know, and polluting, what we need to do is turn that chemical carbon into biological carbon. Biological carbon is life. If the planet has too much chemical carbon and not enough biological carbon, we all die. So it's very important to keep the biological carbon cycle functioning and not to excite or exaggerate the chemical carbon cycle. Biochar, what we're doing is we're taking biological carbon and we are converting it into chemical carbon. When I started to think about it on a large scale or a global scale, and when I analyzed it more, I realized I had to start speaking out against biochar. We've all heard about microplastic pollution in the ocean. Microplastics are micro pieces of chemical carbon from petroleum. Biochar, we now, when I looked into it, because I was saying, okay, well, what's the earliest warning signs that this is the wrong decision? I found some research out of South America, the Amazon to be more precise, where they spoke about the Rio Negro, the Black River, being a tributary to on the Amazon River. That biochar from 800 years ago is what is now making the river black, because the micro biochar that's eroded is no different than a microplastic bead. So we now have the earliest warnings that that great idea is in fact the wrong idea and we shouldn't copy it. It's not doing as much good as we think it is, because I've seen soils get better faster just by earthworms. Living carbon. An earthworm is living carbon. Biochar is chemical carbon. The tunnels, the holes, the aeration that an earthworm creates are far more beneficial to your vegetable garden than biochar. Because whether a whale fills its throat with microbead plastic or with biochar carbon, the bottom line is both fill its gut up and don't leave any space for krill. Like I said, we always have to look for the unintended consequences of our decisions, and we always have to presume that our great idea is in fact a bad idea and look for the earliest evidence that it was in fact a bad idea. And I believe if biochar caught on and went global and went nationwide, it would be very bad. And the next reason it's very bad is when I was producing it, you should have seen the fumes and the gases and the heat that came off burning a tree that would have rotted in 100 years and stayed as part of the biological carbon. We turned it from biological carbon into chemical carbon very quickly, but the process gave off methane gases and many harmful gases and heat.
So speaking of carbon and the X Prize, you had mentioned before to me, and I think this was somewhat of a shock to me, and I'm sure that this will be a shock to most people, that you can sequester more carbon with a grassland than you can in a forest. Did I understand that correctly?
More carbon and deeper.
More carbon and deeper. And we are so in love with trees. And when we think about fixing the desert, that's the first thing everybody wants to do is go plant a tree, because they figure, oh, that'll help with the shade and it'll help with those big old roots. How do you know that the grasslands sequester more carbon?
I've actually got a lovely picture of some trees that I took of in a forest in Germany. Some wind had blown a couple of them over. And I loved it because the entire root of this huge tree that was probably 33 feet wide at the base, 100 feet tall, and it got blown over by some wind. Total root depth, 3 feet.
Oh, wow. 3 feet.
I have dug a tree in Africa in a savanna grassland where at 10 meters, we stopped trying to find the bottom of that tree root. We know from the research that some of the grasses in the savannas, roots are 68 meters deep. And the deepest known legume root we found was 100 meters.
So you're saying that a tree in a forest sequesters less carbon than a tree in a savanna?
So a tree has more carbon, but it's above ground. It's not sequestered. The roots below ground are very minimal.
So sequestering carbon is a function of how many roots you have and how deep they go.
You have to be careful here. Capturing carbon, a tree has captured a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere. Sequestering carbon means taking it below ground. So you see a grass above ground is very little. Below ground, it's very much. It sequesters more carbon.
I think most people mess that up, including me. Capturing versus sequestering, two completely different things.
Correct.
Here's the real question. I know that you believe that you could win the X Prize given 5,000 acre pilot project, and given that whoever owns the land would guarantee they would work the land the way you saw fit for the next 100 years to keep it sequestering carbon and even more carbon every year. How much carbon? I'm sure that that's what the average person wants to know. Okay, well, if you're going to do 5,000 acres, how much carbon is that?
Unfortunately, you didn't warn me you were going to ask me this question. Otherwise, I would have had one of my Excel spreadsheets open, and then I could have just read you an answer. However, in the form of this podcast, all I will say is that we know that grasslands sequester more carbon than forests. With the brittle environments, what you were referring to is if we are able to do our biocarpeting and get the grassland growing again and the desert grassland ecosystem functioning again, and if the people living on the land make a decision to manage that land holistically for the next 100 years, it will accumulate and sequester more and more carbon. If you think of the rich black prairie soils, they are a result, and you know, some of them are over 60 meters deep of black soil. That is 60 meters of millions of years of grass sequestering carbon, being grazed, trampled, regrowing, sequestering carbon, grazed, trampled. Because what happens when a grass is grazed is it sloughs off its roots and it leaves that carbon behind. And this happening over hundreds or millions of years is what sequesters carbon below ground. Without looking at my spreadsheets, I just don't want to give a wrong answer. All the data I've gathered and many others have gathered shows conclusively that grasslands do hold and sequester more carbon than forests do. For the X Prize, you know, the requirement was a gigaton. We believe that we can do that target, can meet that target quite easily as a team. To do it, we would need about 150,000 acres a year. So we can extrapolate from that with 150,000 acres a year, 600,000 cattle being fed, biological carpeting, the forage and grass that we would expect to grow after the first rainy season would meet the targets of a gigaton a year.
For every year, it just keeps getting better, right?
Yes, it's exponential. As I always say, life begets life, more life begets more life. Well, remember, life is carbon. So the more carbon we have, the more life we have, it feeds on itself and it becomes more and more because it's a carbon cycle. And the more that is cycling, the more that there is. The more plants that are photosynthesizing, that's the more sugars they're capturing. And remember, the name for sugar is C3 or C4, carbon 4, carbon 3. That's what the C stands for. Plants photosynthesize, they take carbon out of the atmosphere and they send it down to their roots where it then feeds the fungi and all the other microorganisms, and there's this exchange of nutrients and minerals for carbon. Well, that exchange keeps it below ground. Once you've got a bit of mulch and a few grass plants growing and it stores more moisture, well, that allows more plants to grow. So now there's more mulch and more plants, and well, that allows more plants to grow, and now there's more moisture. So yes, it increases. On a lot of ranches that are not in country as bad as we're looking at around the Salton Sea for the Desert to Grasslands Feeding the Future program, a lot of ranches that started at 0.5% carbon, 1% carbon, have in a matter of 3 years have got up to 4 to 6 to 7% carbon. And it's a totally different ball game when there's that much carbon in the soil. And that's just the top 10 centimeters soil.
That gives me a lot of hope. There's one last question. You've taught us a little bit about sequestering carbon and carbon capture. What are we all doing that would do the opposite and would release carbon into the atmosphere? Because I can think of one thing that I never really realized before watching the TED talk that your dad, Alan Savory, did and that you've talked about. And I suppose most people don't even realize it. It's when you've got plants like on a hill and you see them start turning gray and they're oxidizing. Are they losing carbon?
I call that gray oxidization carbon oxide, as in the plant was made mostly out of carbon and it's oxidizing carbon oxide. I think I'm the only person who uses that phrase, but I think it describes what's happening. Rust is iron oxide.
So the gray plants, the oxidizing of those plants is a bad thing because?
Well, so because it's taken that living plant material from biological carbon and it turns it into chemical carbon. Once it's gone gray, nothing can eat it.
So what do you do with it if it's gone gray?
Well, people burn it.
Is there anything else we can do besides burn it once it's turned gray?
Yes, we can get a big herd of livestock to trample it into the ground. When it's trampled into the ground, then the fungi can begin to break it down.
So other things that people are doing that are causing us to lose that carbon that we've sequestered is burning.
The major issue globally is grass fires followed by forest fires. As Alan said in his TED talk, over 1 billion hectares of Africa gets burnt every year.
And that's only Africa.
That's only Africa. Yeah, you live in California. You should have a look up north.
There's fires going on right now, and we have a hurricane coming. We have another episode that's all about fire. So I think have we covered everything about carbon that you feel like people need to know at this point?
I think the key points, look, I'm trying to keep things simple and trying to use layman's language. I hope I've got the message across. Fire is basically never good, and let's keep fire out and think about the unintended consequences of decisions and try not to think linearly. Try and think about how everything is connected and interconnected. Try and think about how things fit in the whole.
That's the end of today's podcast, but stay tuned. We have so much more coming. We're going to talk about fire. We're going to talk more about deserts to grasslands, how we actually feed the cattle, how we've actually been able to create a model to make this profitable. Because if we can't figure out a way to make greening deserts profitable, it's not going to happen anywhere else in the world. And so if you'd like more information, please find us at fixdeserts.com. That's FIXDESERTS.com.